Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain. Tony is still recovering from an illness earlier, and Sean's been with me for the last few weeks or so and doing a wonderful job. So Sean McNally is with us, and today we have face-to-face. Have the face-to-face with Laurie. This is Laurie Sargent, John Ryder, Billy Beard, and Sean McNally. Say hello, everybody, and welcome to Two Pints in a Corner.
Yeah. Where's my phone?
This is exciting. We have three fifths. We have 60% of the band, and I'll start off by just saying we almost had 80%. Angelo had agreed to join us, but he's still a working musician like all these guys are, and he had a gig pop up, so we understand that completely. So he's not able to join the call today, and I'd be remiss without mentioning Stu Kimball. Stu cannot join us today. He's been dealing with some health stuff as well. And before the call's up, I'm going to make sure Larry mentioned something that's going on and trying to help his cause here. But we got three fifths of face-to-face, and I'm excited about this. I'm an unabashed fan of the band since day one. I remember hearing Out of My Hands. I just was like captivated by the song. Started seeing you guys play the channel. I was instantly hooked to the band. Again, one of those bands I always thought should have been much bigger than they ended up being, but that's the case of so many bands, as we all know. And I'm just happy to have you guys on the phone today. So thanks for making the time to come with us and spend some time.
Definitely. You're welcome.
And thank you, Sean. Thank you for your continued support through the years.
Yeah.
And definitely, John and Laurie. I've been bugging you guys for years and years trying to do a reunion at some point. It's just been difficult for lots of reasons. But, you know, now I know it's impossible, essentially. But that point doesn't mean we can't talk about the good old days. And that's what we're here to do, really. Dinky started this program with Tony to kind of go back and reminisce about, you know, what a magical time the Boston music scene was in the 80s, particularly. You know, we're obviously focused on the channel here. You know, we had Dinky's sound system there, and he was the man, the best stage in town, essentially, to play in. So we just really want to start off by, you know, asking memories you have from playing the club. I know you shot videos there, you played some shows there, you played your last show there, you sold out to the Gills. Who wants to go first? And just give us some basic memories about, well, actually, we'll start with Laurie. Laurie, you want to start with your basic first memories of the club and anything you want to share with us?
I'm happy to start, but I'm going to ensure that John Ryder is ready because he's the only one that really remembers anything because he didn't drink, so anyway, I think that's why. But the channel, I would consider the channel face-to-face's home club. It was, it felt like it was our place, and it was always the place we came back to if we went on tour or if we were away recording for months and months. We always came back there. It was a club in way more ways than a nightclub, you know, and we were really happy to be part of it. The people that worked there were devoted to the club, and they were devoted to music, and treated the bands like family, and I would say, if I can speak for the whole band, which I can because I was the lead singer, it was our favorite club. So.
And it's my job as a bass player. I'll just stand here and nod my head yes, Laurie.
I just jumped for a second. It's funny. When I talked to Laurie yesterday, she said, oh, my God, memories? You have to talk to John. John's the one that was sober. I don't remember anything she said. So I'm going to have you guys kind of fill in the blanks that you need to.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, December 12th, 1980, there was a group called Oak, the Needles, and you were like backing them. They were backing them, but you were one of the first bands. That was the first time that I saw on the data sheet that you played. And then you played it the next time in February 21, 1981, with the Atlantics. You still were not headlining then. You were still opening and what have you. And then Private Lightning.
We didn't sign a record deal until like 83.
Yeah, well, that's...
So we didn't move up the, the depth chart much until that point.
No, well, no, 82. 82 was you opened, you headlined with The Dream. Really? On the 3rd of July, the 3rd of July, and Angry Young Bees opened for you. For you. The Dream then played, and then you played. You were the headliners.
Wow.
And then September 10th, Berlin Airlift, Face to Face, and Sex Execs. January, and that was 82. And then in 83, you only played once. You played there with Robert Harris Oral on Face to Face was playing. And then you got into all kinds of good stuff in 84. 84, you played twice because, you see, on August 9th, 1984, you had a videotaping of the band. And that, you know, I was one of them to talk with, and I'm sure Sean remembers these ones, because this is when I came in 86, and before that, all the lads and Andrew was looking after you on stage doing production, and I think Sean had just got there in 84. I'm not sure whether it was 84, but he will tell you. And then...
I know that you were, not to step on your dick, but yeah, you guys were obviously building a base, and before you had getting signed later on, and we will talk about that connection with, you know, Rick Berlin, the movie, and then how he kind of led the way to you guys getting that deal. But Dickie's basically referring to an online database, just so you guys know. This has not come out the top of his head. We have an online database that Dickie built called Boston's Best Live Rock.com, which, of course, was the tagline for the channel, Boston's Best Live Rock. So if you go to online, the Boston's Best Live Rock.com, you can actually look at every single club year, every date, all the bands that played. It's an incredible reference, especially you just kind of forget, right, how many times you played there and who's on the bill. And so it's a really cool database to have peek at when you get a chance. But this is where Dickie's pulling all these dates from, just so you know.
And that's where
letting us know now.
if he remembers all this off the top, that would scare the shit out of him.
Yeah, me too.
You played 20 times.
Hey, I'm sort of more surprised by 1980.
Yeah.
That was our first show there.
Yeah.
Really?
That must have been Free Laurie.
No, yeah, it might have been.
Well, that's a question. That's one of my questions. I have one date where Laurie Anderson is the is on the headline, is not the headline, but Face to Face is, and then it says, and then it gives your name, Laurie. It's like I'm saying, well, is that when you just first joined the band? That's like 84, and that doesn't make sense.
No, I joined the band in 80, and we got signed in
80. 80,
80.
Oh, I know what
80, 81.
I know what it is. It's 86, Berlin the movie, and then it says Laurie Sargent and Face to Face. That's what it says on it.
Okay. Wow, I never knew we went. Oh, wow.
You're working behind our back, were you? Huh?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought you'd be there from the beginning, because Sean has been following you from before that, I think. When you first started, you guys, because he really enjoyed the material and what how you performed and everything. You tell him, Sean. Not
Dinky, me. Let me also say that I'd like to apologize on the behalf of the band and ourselves that we did abuse that sound system.
We know that, everyone did, so I ain't worried.
Charlie Farron once remarked, he said, "Face to Face must mix with a hockey stick."
Yeah. It's how you did it. I mean, you could get, you know, and we had some very loud bands in there, like Man of War and stuff, and I'm going like, okay, that's about 140 at the back. People, it's more than a jet engine. I'm saying, okay, let's we turn it up now.
I think it was 140 just by that drum monitor. blew my head off.
Well, it's so you could express yourselves in town.
Yeah.
That's all. I mean, that's the way I looked at it.
People to talk.
Okay.
No talking while we're playing. We're going to ensure that you cannot talk.
Charlie. All right. So go on, Sean. You've been talking to everybody, so you You're going to ask some great questions.
Let's back a little bit. And I did talk to all three of you guys yesterday, and I appreciate that. It just kind of helps to set the tone for the call, and it just kind of gives me some more background. So I do appreciate that. And I think I told all of you guys, as we have these calls and talk, and, you know, somebody might say one thing, and it spurs a memory to someone else, and, you know, oh, my God, I forgot all about that. So that's kind of the idea we're going to try and have here is let's go back and reminisce what a good time it was that time. And I know we talked to Laura yesterday about how supportive – and this is also another common theme with these calls, how supportive the scene was at the time with you know, the radio stations, which was gigantic, the Phoenix. I like how you said it was – I said there was competition back then, but it was really like more of a sibling rivalry, which I think is a great way to call it, Laura, because everybody was trying to become the biggest band they could, right? And there were so many bands that headlined the channel back at that time that were like legitimate, you know, could have headlined anywhere in the country if they get the exposure they deserved. But – we'll be talking about how the BCM thing happened, and also how Rick Berlin did help you guys get to that, you know, essentially a showcase.
Yeah.
You want to take that, Lori?
Sure. So, like Sean is saying, my recollections of being in the Boston music scene in the time period that we're talking about were there was a beautiful camaraderie and competition between a lot of bands who were all poised to, quote unquote, hit it big. Our rehearsal space in Kenmore Square had, I don't know how many rooms, I want to say 30 rooms, you know, with bands that practiced almost every night, you know, and we'd run into each other out in the halls and, you know, talk about where we were at and what was going on. And it was just really, it was really cool. And supportive. And also, you know, I can't think of a major city in this country that had what we had, which was tons of clubs to play at that were open 7 nights a week and audiences that were interested in hearing music 7 nights a week. And I think it was really driven by our radio stations who, you know, when we were coming up and, you know, right up till around when we, you know, made our first record, they were playing local bands as if they were a national act. Yep. There was no local slot. It was, you know, we were played, you know, back to back with giant bands. And so it was just amazing exposure, and it really helped. It was a win-win for everyone.
Yeah. You know, I would add to that, that real estate played a huge part in it. It was so affordable to live here. And, you know, if fast forward to now, just to sort of go off tangentially a little bit, is that it's impossible. I don't know how any young band is going to come out of this city because it's impossible to live here. So it was a really special time. And I agree with Lori 100%. There was a camaraderie aspect. There was also the competition could get cutthroat at times, both from bookers and from bands, because everybody's trying to get a record deal. Exactly. Everybody's trying to get signed.
Yeah,
and that turned the heat up quite a bit, I think.
Yeah,
it also made you all better at what you were doing, right? It was a good competition in that way. It really had to get your tone your own skills and make sure you guys were at that level you needed to be.
Yeah,
there was this one time in particular where we were co-headlining. I never got the concept of co-headlining except to make everybody feel better. Somebody's going on first. Somebody's going on second. And so we paid our crew an extra $100 or something to get our stuff up to the Hampton Beach Casino and get our drum set and our backline set up before John Butcher's crew could get there, because we were co-headlining with the Axes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I like that one.
So, there was a big kerfuffle.
You know, I talked about this yesterday quite a bit. The dynamics of Boston then and now is just you can't ignore it. It's just it's such a shame, unfortunately. Like to Lori's point, we were so lucky. We didn't realize at the time how many venues there were. You could play every night of the week if you wanted to, and that you would not be basing on your own audience. You could play anywhere, and there was clubs in the north of Boston, south of Boston, the Cape, down. You played a college circuit all over New England, and it was not going to affect your draw when you play the channel the next time. It didn't matter. People out every night of the week. It was so inexpensive. You could get tickets for $3, $4, or $5. Living in Boston was so cheap compared to now, and we just didn't realize it. And unfortunately, like to Billy's point, you know, the real estate, you can't afford to have anything in Boston. Never mind a club, but I mean, even living tab has almost become so cost prohibitive. It's really a shame that people have to leave Boston to try and make it elsewhere nowadays. And that's kind of the theme it's been lately for quite a while now.
Well, even with that situation as it was, there were still some of us starting out back then that couldn't even afford the cheap rents. Because I remember this, and Lori and I have talked about this before, but Rick Berlin's keyboard player, Jane Bauman, Jane, yes, who is now the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, like she's massive worldwide, wow, huge. She was living in the rehearsal spaces at Storyville,
yeah,
with her dog,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It was like incredible.
Yeah. That was... you do what you had to do back then, right? Maybe take the point about Rick Berlin. You guys supported Rick Berlin, the movie, but Rick was a fan early on as well of you guys. And tell us how that led to you guys getting a showcase at the Paradise.
That's easy. Rick Berlin, it was called, I think, Rick Berlin, the movie,
yeah,
at the time, 82, 83. And so they had a gig at the Paradise. We were booked to open for them. And they had they had finished their record. They were on Epic or Island, or they were on some division of CBS. And so the guys were coming up from New York to hear them play, and they weren't going to get there in time to hear the opening act. And Berlin held the show. He held the show deliberately so that we could go on. Once those guys arrived, he said, "You guys can go on now." He held the show so we would get exposed. We did get exposed. We did generate interest. And through the course of a long and convoluted story, we ended up getting signed to Epic about a year or so later when Jimmy Iovine got interested in the band.
Oh.
They signed us right away. But that introduced us to the guys at Epic and started a relationship that we pursued aggressively for the next year or so.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool point to the camaraderie of him actually holding the show, holding it.
Yeah.
So the agents are right. That's pretty amazing. Now, was that the show? I think Lars, was Tommy Tutone on that show as well? Was he the headlining act? No.
So that must have been a different show because it's funny because my recollection was that we got signed off of the Tommy Tutone show at the Paradise. So Rick must have introduced
us. Did they come back to that one?
They came back. They came back to that one.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. They were interested, and then they said their budget was used, and then Jimmy got interested some 6 months later, and then they came back.
I gotcha. That's great.
That was it. Tommy Tutone. We opened for a lot of English bands.
It's okay. You can play in front of some people. That's the idea. You can put as many audience you can.
Yeah.
So that led to the deal. And I know that Dick Wingate became an early fan of you guys. And like you said, it was kind of a convoluted thing. The deal took a while. And then maybe you can talk about that fact that Jimmy got involved, Jimmy Iovine, and then the movie came up with like Streets of Fire. And I think that further delayed the whole recording process. Anybody want to talk to that a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
It's really frustrating.
I can interject a little bit. John, you can double check my facts. Even before the whole Dick Wingate thing got involved, we had become friends with a guy named Arthur Baker, and who wound up being a huge, you know, hip hop producer. And Arthur and his wife, Tina, who was a lawyer, had a guy named Jay Bergen, who was a lawyer. They were all sort of interested in the band at a really early stage. And once CBS got interested, we kind of turned the reins over to Jay to try to solidify a deal and work with Jimmy, because he knew Jimmy from working with John Lennon. In New York City, and Jay was a New York City lawyer, and Jay was in constant contact trying to get Jimmy to hear our demos, to be involved, which he finally did. And it was, the label had kept telling us that it was, they didn't have the budget. Epic only got a certain amount of money from CBS each year to sign new acts, and they had already spent it. And so behind the scenes, we're frustrated, we're waiting to see what happens. And all of a sudden, Jay calls and says, "Iovine wants to produce your record." He's like really into it. And the minute Epic heard that Iovine was involved, they came up with the money.
They found the money.
So that sort of got the ball really moving.
Yeah.
And then it started the waiting game. We had sort of stopped playing gigs, and we're waiting and waiting and waiting months for Jimmy to say, "Come to LA. We're ready to go." And I don't know. I'll let one of you guys pick it up from there.
He had been working with Stevie Nicks and Tom Petty, and they put together that Stop Dragging My Heart Around. And we went to New York City to meet Jimmy. And we're walking into the hotel to meet him in the middle of the day. And there was this limousine and all these kids out front. And as we're walking through the lobby, Tom Petty walks right by us in his top hat and everything on his way to Saturday Night Live. So we go upstairs to meet Jimmy. And it's like, holy cow, we're getting like, you're getting that elevated feeling already. You know, so he gave us a good talking to, which is kind of his thing. He's a great pitch man. And we knew we wanted to work with him, knew we wanted to work with Shelly Yakis as the engineer. We just kind of pushed and pushed, and Jay stayed on the case to keep us in the front of people's mind. I mean, Jimmy heard us because he was taking out, and his girlfriend just said, "What's this cassette?" She put it on the boombox, and she goes, "Jimmy, this is good. Jimmy,
that's awesome.
Listen to this.
Wow.
This is great." And he got, "Oh, yeah, you're right, Vicky." Yeah. So,
Crazy. Anyway.
What happened, I don't know whatever really happened, but we were playing a gig at Dick Doherty's club down in Hyannis, down the Cape somewhere, the Crystal Palace. And I remember the night because he had his own dress, he had his own band and his own act, and he had this green room, but there were these closets full of these costumes he wore, these Elvis-like costumes, and we were just going crazy, having fun with that. And we got a call, Jay called somebody, and that's... He probably called Billy, and that's when we heard that Epic was ready to sign us, and Jimmy was ready to go. Is that right?
Everybody remember that? I do remember. I would never have remembered it was at that club, but I do remember getting the phone call.
Well, Dick was my first sponsor, so I knew.
Yeah, I remember that. But But I think even after that point, they're ready to go. We're going to sign the deal. But it was months. He was working on Seeger's record. Remember? And it just kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. Yeah. And finally, we got the green light and flew to L.A. And we're there for like a week before we ever met him. he had an associate named Gordon Perry, who was connected through Stevie Nicks' world. And Gordon shows up at the studio with Shelly on our first day, and like, we're like, who's this guy? And apparently,
who the fuck are you? Where'd you come from?
Yeah, I'm producing your record. We're like, what? Ugh. So it started up.
He was the nicest guy, though, and he was
such a nice guy.
He owned a radio station, and he owned the studio in Dallas called Goodnight Dallas, where Buckingham and Nicks recorded their record that got them signed to Fleetwood Mac. So, you know, that's how he knew Stevie. And so there's this interweb of all this other stuff. And so Jimmy shows up finally, and he's telling us stories and so forth and so on. He does more talking than producing, frankly. But in any case, Gordon was a great guy. Shelly Yakis was a great guy. And so we had fun with them. But it was such slow moving because we were just a young, eager band. Let's rock. Turn them on. Let's rock. And these guys are like, let me hit that snare drum for another 3 or 4 hours. We spent all day listening to a snare drum. And
what you're saying is it's all Billy's fault.
Yeah, yeah.
Been there,
you know,
done that.
And then we get to play. We go to play up there, and it was like – very frustrating. So we finally got some tracks cut, and then and Jimmy is working on, he's always working on at least a couple projects simultaneously. And one of them was as the music director for this movie called Streets of Fire. He's always getting these panicked phone calls from Joel Silver, who's now one of the biggest producers or was. And so he's getting these panicked phone calls. Jimmy, what are we going to do about Alan Ames' band? What are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about that? And driving Jimmy crazy. And Jimmy just puts his hand over the phone. He looks at us and he goes, "You guys want to be in a movie?" Sure.
Unbelievable.
I got it. Because Diane wanted to be a singer. So she took the role so she could sing the parts. But turns out she couldn't sing well enough. So, you know, they said, "Let's put Lori's voice on it. We'll get the guys to act as her band. And Jimmy won't be tied up with this bunch of rookies from Boston any longer." So that's kind of how that worked out. We got to be in a movie, and Lori got to sit there and watch us all day.
Unbelievable.
Unfortunately. So, you know, we came back to New York. We worked with Arthur Baker. We worked with Mike Baker. And we recorded, you know, in several studios in New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts. And we put together the rest of the album. And that kind of finishes us up there.
Crazy. Yeah, it's amazing. It's crazy. You know, common theme of how much the music business just sucks, right? I mean, it just, especially when you can't imagine, you guys, this is like your first chance, your first record. You're all ganged up, ready to rock and roll. And it's like, delay. And they go, let's try this instead. Let's do a movie. Oh, my God. I would have got out of my mind. I can't imagine how frustrating it must have been for you guys. Oh,
yeah,
terrible.
That's frustrating, big time. And
so you guys were with Jimmy, and the debut was called Face to Face, right? And again, the first song I heard was Out of My Hands. I don't know if that was even a single or not. I know the other songs were more the dance songs, like Under the Gun, 1098 became the bigger hits you guys were known for. But how was the, when you finally got in the studio with him, what was the recording process like? I mean, like you said, was he just kind of around, and or did he have any real input into the process, or was it more Baker and the other folks involved?
With Iovine?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was more of a sort of supervisor. Shelly would, you know, take care of the sounds and all that stuff. And if he didn't hear some, he wouldn't give us direct input like the other guys we'd worked with back home, like Mike Baker or anybody else. He'd be like, I don't hear it, so try it again. You know, and somebody else would say, you know, that bridge needs some more energy, or, you know, change this part or change that. And so we were like standing around, what do you guys think? Yeah. And it was not a good fit by any stretch, although, you know, he has a big name. So that got traction.
There's a quote that I've used that I remember Jimmy saying. I've used it for many years in different situations, which was, we were struggling with the bridge of one song, and Jimmy came in and he said, you don't hear it. I something's wrong with that. Well, why don't you just write another song? Angelo's like, what? And he said, and then he goes, I'm sorry. Did I offend you? I thought you were a songwriter. I thought that's what you did.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It was just a slap in the face, and it was so hard to hear. But, I mean, he's coming off working with Tom Petty, you know? It's like,
It's
and he said years later, he said, do you think Tom Petty really needs a producer? He just needs a producing coach, which is what I do. You know, he's got Jimmy, I would still argue to this day, has an incredible ear for music, for hits, you know, and I think it is panned out. I know there's this like legendary story, I don't know if it's true or not, where he was working with Eminem and they were finishing up something for 8 Mile. And he said, I don't hear the single. I think you need to write another song. And Eminem goes, oh yeah, okay. And he goes home that night and he comes back with that. Wow, what's that? Dun, dun, dun. What if you only had one chance, one time? Massive, you know, it's such a good song. And some people can rise up to it like that, you know?
We were kind of new at that point. Those songs took years to craft.
I mean, how unfair is it to compare you to Tom Petty? You guys are brand new baby band. These guys are like, you know, Petty's been out there for years doing his thing, right?
Mm-hmm. He told us a story in the control room there one time. He was talking about working with Petty and Stan Lynch. And they were talking about trying to capture the feel of a particular song. And he'd go, so I had a turntable and I put on Beast of Burden. And then I put on Refugee. Right. Refugee, Beast of Burden, Beast of Burden, Refugee. He says, see? And we're like, what? Yeah. But later on, during the Tom Petty bio on Netflix or something like that, they told that same story.
Yeah,
and
I remember
freaked
that.
Me out. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I will add
one little addendum to the whole Streets of Fire, that out of the five of us, there was one sane person who saw everything, and that was Lori Sargent. She really had a bead on that whole scenario. And we were led into the depths of depravity. Right by the cheek.
Well, oh yeah, but happily
Lori,
too.
Lori
happily too.
Through. Happily. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Lori really put up with an incredible amount of bullshit around that whole.
Lori
thing.
Was always the moral center.
Yeah.
You know, if it pissed Lori off, you know, it was going to end. Whatever it was, you know, if she could tolerate it, we would do it.
Yeah. I like that.
So, The record comes out, and you know, I think it, you know, it's a pretty good success, I would think. A couple of radio songs and whatnot on the charts, and you guys did tour on that album, I believe. And I forget if I know you toured different points with the Psychedelic Furs and the Romantics, I think, and I know the Alarm for sure. But what was the whole on the road as a you know, a recorded band and on a tour kind of thing? What was that like for you guys the first time really leaving the New England area?
All of it was like a wonderland, you know. It was all first time around for us. Oh my God, is this what the life is? You know, we go out to this place in Fort Wayne with was it the Romantics? Yeah, with the Romantics, and we all go scurrying across the highway to buy cowboy boots, you know, and we all come scurrying back, and we line up the boots in front of the bus, and then we go and we play the show. Must have been the first time. It was the first week that 1098 was released. And we go do our 30 minutes, and we go off, and they do their thing, and then we're all packed up, and we go, we carrying our whatever, our luggage out to the bus up the ramp, and these kids are screaming our names. They're singing 1098. They knew who we were after MTV had been playing us just a couple of days. It was amazing.
Pretty surreal feeling, right? We probably should have mentioned as well how important MTV was in that era, because that was all brand new as well at the time.
Yeah.
How really elevated bands, you know.
It was the bigger, bigger the market.
Yeah, I don't want to step on that. I think I've taken the whole thing over. Dick, you have any questions you want to run in? I have a bunch more stuff, but I don't want to leave you in the background here.
No, I'm enjoying everything you guys are saying. I love it. Larry's in you've got, she's the only sane one. I know that how bad you guys used to get wasted in the channel. So I'm saying, yeah. But it's cool.
Yeah.
It's very, very cool. I'm like.
And then we'd have everybody back to the house in Brighton.
Yeah. Oh, well, those were the days. You could do all that stuff and get away with it. You're young.
And bounce back by noon. You know?
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. Sometimes you had to bounce back early because you had an afternoon show and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or a day job.
Oh, yeah, the day job.
Yeah, right. So I to jump too fast ahead, but so there were three records you guys put out, the debut, Confrontation, with that was at Ed Stasium, I think. And then the last record was One Big Day with Ants on Fear. And that was really where a pretty big change in your sound, I would say, with the whole, it wasn't album being termed yet, but Americana, so to speak, and the country flavor. And that was
That's the one that felt like us. That's the one that felt like us being us.
It was such a really, really good record, man. I feel like it gets lost, and because it's so different than, you know, 1098 and Under the Gun, and people would probably be like, who is this band? But you guys totally, to me, felt like you really found your groove and you fell into it, and it just sounded like so natural and like really all the way through, not just the thing, you know, As Forever As You, Place Called Home, She's a Contradiction, The Grass Is Greener. I think Laurie still plays that. I mean, it's such good stuff, just really, really good music. I'm just curious, like, how did you guys arrive? Was that the natural progression, you think, or just kind of you were leaning that way, or how did it end up with that being the last record?
I think we were listening. I think it was, I think 1098 and Under the Gun were not really representative of us. I think we were very young and impressionable, and Arthur kind of saved our ass because we ended up, you know, Jimmy kind of ended up sort of losing interest in the project, I would say. That's what it felt like. And we needed a couple more songs, and Arthur came in, and Mike Baker, who was in the band The Rings, the Boston band The Rings, which were a great band. And they, you know, they helped shape songs that would go on the record. And I think that we did those songs to, you know, under Arthur's influence. And they were really fun. It was fun to stretch out. And we had gone, you know, when we were in L.A. making our record, Beardo and I in particular started getting really into going to clubs with hip-hop and rap music, and we were really like fascinated by breakdancing, and you know, it's like a whole other culture of music. And then when we, you know, when we came around to making One Big Day, I think we kind of had a feeling that things were shifting for us and our future might not be long. And I think it kind of represented the music that a lot of us started to listen to, which was like John Hiatt. And, you know, that sort of precursor to Americana, quote unquote.
Yeah,
I think it did, you know, like we would, come into rehearsal and bring in records that we had found that were in that vein. And it was just giving us shivers. Like, we really loved that music. And it, I think it was just a natural, like, take a deep breath, have a big sigh, and play music that represents you, you know, like, yeah, that we were more ourselves, I think. And we weren't trying, you know, we weren't, like, desperate to, like, make an impression. We just wanted to make music that we liked. And I know a lot of people really wished that we had stuck with, say, Out of My Hands, you know, and the harder, the, you know, more rock music. But it's where we went. And I like the record probably the best out of all of our stuff.
Well, without a doubt. We weren't working so hard to try to be something. We were just being us. Roll the tape. Let's play what we play, and let's just do what we feel, and make the arrangements what they are. Yeah. And
in the meantime, you're doing all that. The channel's there, not just for you guys to play, but tell us about the people that you come to see, not just the locals, but also the headliners that are passing through that caught your eye and said, well, I'd like to go see Roy Orbison or something like that. But tell us a few things that they used to go see without performing down the channel.
I remember Beardo coming to a rehearsal one day, and he had been to see Roy Orbison the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about how he did that growl and all the women would go crazy.
My two shows that I remember the most, and aside from local shows, but one was Bow Wow Wow, who I loved, and they went on, like, it was so wild. I'd never been to a show where the headliner went on like an hour and a half late. You know, it was just like they went on so late, and I don't remember.
You never saw the Who?
And then the other one that I will never forget was the Plasmatics.
Oh, wow. That's interesting stuff.
Yeah,
I think I was at that show.
It was
amazing, but I can't remember it, but it was unforgettable.
Oh, freaking Wendy O. Wendy O with the chainsaw, you know, it's like that.
That performance art was absolutely great for her. I mean, she was just right on with it and everything she did.
Yeah,
it's performance art. It's not, I mean, that's basically what you're looking at, those kind of bands like Gwar and stuff like that. They're all performance art.
But they're
focused on something that they really like, and they just took it to the max. And she did it so much into the max. Unfortunately, she did it in a bad way in some way towards the end there. Other than that, performance on stage was just fantastic. I mean, just to what she did with everything. But those bands that were coming through were sort of excited because you sort of listened to that live, and not just on record, and not just this. You saw how they performed, like going back to Rick Berlin and a movie, how they performed and how they did. And you took a little bit of that here and there, but you gave it your own Boston stuff. And the thing about doing that is that it just got you inspired to do it your way. And when other people came in to change your way, it wasn't your way anymore. It was the vibe that was coming from people like in L.A., people from New York and this, that, and the other, and you didn't need that. You needed yourself, and you needed to be able to just show, well, look, this is what we do. This is how we play. This is what we do. We don't need to change ourselves because you said so and things like
that.
That's
one reason we never went back to L.A. to record, is like we realized that was like on another planet. We were at home in Boston and New York, and that's where we felt right, and that's where we determined to work.
Exactly. That's the whole thing. That's your background and stuff, you know. And I mean, I've recorded some platinum albums in L.A. with Steely Dan, and other people have recorded Birds albums in there with them. And the thing is, it's a factory, and with it being a factory, there's a lot of less camaraderie, unless you go to the whiskey and hang out late night and get trashed with everybody that's around. And then that was them days. I'm talking in the 60s and 70s. The 80s.
We actually did that. We went to the whiskey and got trashed.
Oh, good.
For the, the Eddie and the Cruisers rap party.
Oh, yeah.
We went to see our friends in Beaver Brown were playing it that night.
That's great.
That's right.
I did a show a few years ago with the James Montgomery Band and John Cafferty and Tunes were sitting in for a feature part of the set. And I went on my phone and I scooped and I found a picture of that gig, them playing at the Whiskey. I showed it to him. Yeah. But it was a thrill to play those songs behind John and Tunes.
See, that's what.
But anyway, they dug that photo.
That's what it's all about—the vibe and stuff, and the feeling that you get, and that's what you portray to the audience. You know, when you went up there, Larry, and you just let it go, and the band behind you is just whipping it, especially bass, whipping it. I would say I'd turn around and go, whoa, now they got something going here, what have you.
Yeah.
But it was real to me. It was real for the real band. Like, you know, I love Rick Berlin. I love his way he performs and what he does for people and what he's always done for people. And I'm from a different era. I'm from the 60s in England. I had a club in the 66. It's like, okay. So I didn't care that much at first for a lot of the new stuff going on. But then when I heard it was all the Boston stuff, I says, this is fantastic. This is really a real scene, just like London was in the 60s, just like Sheffield was in the 60s, just like where I grew up was in the 60s. This is the scene. Everybody's a friend that they really admire each other. And then the ones that didn't, you still check them out because they got something going. You know, the Dream, the ex-Dream, all those people that you played with that are open for, are then headlined, that they open for you and this, that, and the other. You got the vibe going. They got the vibe going. And it that's the kind of stuff. And if you're just stuck in there with the Boston, which you did eventually, you're all stuck with the Boston crowd and stuff, it now is so monstrous around the country, the Boston sounds. You know, we got stuff here out in Asheville with Tom Hambridge, with Robert Harris Oral. We've got all these bands that played in Boston and engineers and people that work there at the channel. They're all living in Nashville and working out of Nashville because that's the scene today. The scene, not L.A. Not although L.A.'s got its scene with the punk stuff and still a lot of metal out there, but everything else is all in Nashville and what have you. New York is not, but Boston still got it. With you guys, some of them are still playing and having fun, and I really like that. You know, I really think that you're going to play forever at that point. Even though there's day jobs and this, that, and the other, you're still going to play, and you're not going to drop it out and whatever, and as you get older, you're still going to do it, you know?
Yeah, so, I was gonna actually go from there, Dickie, because people might just think that they played their last show in '88, which was, I do want to talk about that before we hang up the phone for sure. But you guys have all been lucky to stay in music essentially since the Channel days and since Face to Face Call of the Day in '88. Maybe I'll just give each of you guys give you a few minutes each to kind of toot your own horn on what you've been doing. I mean, I've talked to all you guys before, but I know. Well, give me a chance to tell our audience. So, Billy, let me start with you. You've been crazy busy for quite a while. Maybe tell us what you've been doing for the last 40 years, I guess, right?
Well, I was going to say one thing about, but you brought up Robert Ellis Oral. Life after Face to Face for me really started in Nashville. And it was really Bob Oral that had moved down there. He was the first guy. And he really sort of begged Angelo to move down. He thought Ange's songwriting would do well there. And Ange went down first in 93, and then I kind of followed suit in 94 when he introduced me to a woman named Kim Ritchie. And Kim was signed to Mercury Nashville. And I toured with her for 4 years, and we made her second record. And that sort of just launched a whole another side to my playing career. So I did that for a few years and then wound up with Patty Griffin, played with her for another 4 years, and then eventually sort of decided I wasn't going to tour that much anymore. I did one more sort of cross-country run with Melissa Ferrick. Yeah. And then settled at home, had a baby, and second baby. And the next thing I knew, this band Such an Americana started at Toad, and then that took me to Europe 15 times. It's been nonstop ever since. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, other than the personal life stuff. But playing-wise, I just feel I've been really lucky to play with amazing artists out of this city.
That's great.
And it's been, been kind of a fun ride all those years.
That's great.
Don't leave out the fact, Billy, you were the booking agent at Toad and Richard Lounge for big years. So those are very well-known venues in Boston that you were really overseeing for quite a while. That was a big help as well, helping the scene.
Yeah. It was an interesting challenge for all those years.
Sure.
But it really kept me in the loop as far as like up-and-coming acts.
Yeah.
And getting introduced to stuff that I normally would never have been. So in that respect, it was pretty great.
That's cool.
John, how about you, buddy? Tell us about you. You're still playing, obviously. Let us know what's been happening with you since the post face-to-face day, so to speak.
Yeah. After that, I was in a really deep funky state for a long time. I didn't pick up a bass for a while, but I did. So I was pursuing a different career in electronics and all like that. But it was the drummer from the Axis, Derek Blevins, that reached out and asked me to join him on a project he was doing and go out and buy an amp. So I had to do that. I had one or two basses left and no amp. And so I went out and got an amp and started working with him. And that just got me relit. That relit the fire.
Yeah,
that restoked it.
It's cool.
And I stayed in my day job for up until last August, really. I stayed in a career, had a nice career. But I pursued, like, I reconnected with James Montgomery about 25, 30 years ago. And I've been subbing in his band whenever his guy can't make it. I couldn't take on a full-time gig. So I've developed a bit of a niche as a sub. So any one of a half a dozen, six, seven, eight bands that I had going over the years at any given time would call like last minute or a week in advance and say, can you make this job? And I, great. So I love the variety. I I did upright bass with Bellevue Cadillac and a number of other groups. And just now starting up a project with John Butcher and Diane Blue called Shades of Blue.
Oh yeah.
We're just putting together the Facebook page and the website and all that. We did a video and a photo shoot this week. And so we got our first, not our first gig, but we've got a real showcase coming up April 4th at Tupelo in Derry, New Hampshire. We got James Montgomery opening and we're really looking forward to breaking out in the scene. We got about a dozen gigs booked so far. We hope to fill out the rest of the calendar later.
Yeah, Shades of Blue is a really fun act. I've seen it a couple of times already. It's a really great. People who like music in general will really appreciate it. You got John Butcher, John Ryder, Diane Blue, AJ's on the drums. And, it's just been a couple of shows I've seen so far. And there are a bunch coming up starting with April 4th at Tupelo. So anybody in the area wants to go check them out.
Dynamic with John Butcher. His rock and blues sensibility, and Diane Blue with her blues and her harp playing, and they both very skilled leaders as band leaders. Mm-hmm. And they kind of can go back and forth, and it offers a great dynamic to the audience. It keeps it very live and fresh. We don't have set lists.
That's great, actually. I like that.
Yeah. We're going to start with this, and then one of those two leaders will just start something or look at us, and then when it's time for a solo, somebody just takes a solo. And when it's time for the solo to end, yeah. So that keeps everything fresh. Yeah, we love that.
Before we get to Laurie, I do want to mention, obviously, Angelo's on the call. He couldn't make it, but again, staying in the music theme, Angelo's been extremely busy. He went down to Nashville. He's become a producer. He actually was very involved with the Kings of Leon, who had a massive hit, Sex on Fire. I'm sure most people have heard it on the radio about 15 years ago, won a Grammy for that. He's been working with Kim Ritchie for a while, Patty Griffin. I know he's written songs, Taylor Swift, Peter Wolf, Black Keys, Yeah, Womack, Brooks and Dunn. So, again, it's great that these guys keep it up there, still do what they do and what they love, and it's become a career. And, of course, for Stu, Stu is an amazing guitar player, super talented. He worked with Peter Wolf, Carly Simon, Springsteen, Data Ross, Stevie Nicks. I mean, Bob Dylan is probably the best way in the more recently times. He was the lead guitar for 13 years with Dylan, which is not an easy gig, man. I'll tell you that. So he had to wear a lot of hats in that role, and Stu was great in that respect. He's also heavily involved with Woody Geisman, we know from the Del Fuegos, of course, a program called Bottom, which is about recovery and helping out musicians and whatnot. And I just want to put a little plug in for this. If you want to go online, Woody's program with this Rock Bottom, it's called Recover Your Life. So it's basically the word recover, Y-O-U-R, then .life. And they'll give you more information on that whole program. But I do want to have Laurie talk about her career as well, but also mention what's going on currently with Stu and another cause that Laurie's very, very involved in. But maybe talk about the music first, Laurie, that you've been doing since then, and we can talk about that part.
Oh, okay. I am not pursuing music so much anymore. I'm doing it when it's fun. So if someone invites me to sit in with them, I say yes if I like them. And that has been really nice. And occasionally, like David Hurley from O Positive just asked me more than once, which I, you know, bless his heart, if I would open for him at a show at Passim. And I said yes, which meant I had to drag the kids out and remember how to play my own songs and all of that. But and Beardo joined me for that one, which was really, really fun.
Oh, that's good.
After Face to Face ended, I kind of dinked around. I dinked around for a bit, and then got a record deal with Reprise and worked with Russ Titelman, and it was all really fun. And then, you know, the label did not support my record, and that kind of stuff with the music business keeps me, you know, out of the music business. It's too heartbreaking. It's a cruel industry, so.
It really is.
A lot of other things. So mostly what I'm doing now is running a nonprofit called the Billy Conway Artist Fund, which was created in honor of my very longtime partner and husband, Billy Conway, who was in Treat Her Right, who opened for us at the Channel. We kind of took turns opening for each other as our stars kind of rose and fell. So anyway, Billy passed away 4 years ago, and we, the Artist Fund supports Indigenous or Native artists in Montana, where we lived up until right before he died. It's a great program, and you can find that online, BillyConwayArtistFund.org. Regarding Stu, so our beloved Stu was diagnosed a bunch of years ago with early onset Alzheimer's, and he and his wife, Michelle, dealt with that for a long time before they went public with it. And they are very public now about raising awareness about the disease and what the early warning signs are for that disease. It ran in Stu's family. His mom had it. And it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's talk about cruel. It's something that a person is aware of as they decline. And Stu is unfortunately at a point where he's not really able to play anymore. And we did a GoFundMe for them to help with expenses for sort of people to come in and help Michelle take care of him, and also to find a professional place for him to eventually go to. So if people are interested in supporting that cause, there's so many amazing causes, but since, you know, we are face-to-face and Stu is part of us, I mean, I'd encourage this one in particular that should just go to GoFundMe and put in Stu and Michelle Kimball and throw some bucks toward it. It would be hugely appreciated.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for that, Laurie. Yeah, it's really such a sad thing. To have your most, you know, the thing you most care about and taken away, and it's just such a horrible thing to see happen to somebody you know, especially. But it's really great that there are people out there that can help out, and if you can't help, both on Billy's fund, Stu's fund, face to face, touch a lot of people out there, folks. Anybody listening here, if you got a few bucks to kick around, maybe you've made some money over the years, do the right thing. You know, these guys are still out there doing their thing, and we all need help here and there once in a while. So if you're in this position where you can do that, please do that, because it's they're both very, very worthy causes. Well, so yes. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you all. Thank you, Larry. We're going to head out now, and want to thank you all for this lovely conference call and interviews and everything else from your life. we much appreciate it. Very much. And the people I know on the podcast are going to love it, because it's around the world. It's not just here in Boston. It goes out on many of them. There's six different platforms it goes out on, from Spotify to YouTube to Amazon to all these different ones on Two Pints in a Corner. And you guys, I have to tell you something. You're the 50th one of 100 shows. We've only done 50, and this is a biggie, and I'm going to be promoting it even more over different things, because it's so wonderful to hear your recollection of what went down, what you're doing now, and all these causes that's necessary. And we're with you, Sean, and I are with you, and I'd like to say Two Pints in the Corner is closing out.